Hello, and you are listening to Eco Justice Radio on KPFK Los Angeles. A project of SoCal 350 Climate Action, our show presents environmental and climate stories from a social justice frame, featuring voices not necessarily heard on mainstream media. Eco Justice Radio acknowledges that we record the show on the traditional territory of the Tongva. Welcome. I am Jessica Aldridge. On today's show, The Right to Repair Your Gadgets and Why You Should Care, I will be interviewing Carrie Maeve Sheehan, U.S. Policy Lead for iFixit, and Nathan Proctor, U.S. PERG Senior Right to Repair Campaign Director. Carrie Maeve Sheehan is the U.S. Policy Lead at iFixit, where she advocates for right to repair at the state, federal, and international levels. She is a graduate of Boston University of Law and comes to iFixit from the Electronic Frontier Foundation and Public Knowledge, where she worked extensively on public interest issues in intellectual property law and technology policy. Nathan Proctor is a 15-year veteran on public interest advocacy campaigns and is also the associate director of U.S. PERG New Economy Program, seeking to craft an economy that works for people and the planet. He is a member of the 2020 GRIST 50 Fixers Emerging Leaders Championing a Sustainable Future. If you own something, shouldn't you be able to take it to a technician of your choice or fix it yourself and be given access to the parts, tools, and service information necessary? Well, that seems like a reasonable ask, but this isn't always the case. Large corporations like Apple are aggressively lobbying against the consumer's ability to repair their own devices. They have enacted a $1 trillion lobbying campaign against right to repair that is fueling the fastest growing waste sector in the world, electronic waste. The mining, processing, and transportation of precious materials for our devices is a leading contributor to environmental and social justice issues. Today, we speak about the right to repair movement, the social and environmental implications, the opposition's efforts, and how and why we must move the needle. Did you know that tractor manufacturers have strong-armed the agricultural industry, not allowing them to personally fix their equipment if it breaks down, or that at-capacity hospitals with limited supplies are not able to get their hands on the service manuals needed to fix broken respirators and baby incubators? Companies keep you from repairing your goods by requiring specific tools or gluing the working parts together, limiting access to software, and working with border control to clamp down on so-called counterfeit parts. Is this about product safety or more so profiting off of repairs, increasing consumer purchases, and driving market share? What will it take for people to be given the right to fix their own stuff easily and without repercussions? States and the federal government are listening. There are numerous right to repair initiatives being proposed in states around the USA. Even the Biden administration has signed on to an executive order in support. The EU and Canada are moving forward as well. So what does this all mean? Keep listening. Our guests are experts in the area of right to repair, and this is sure to be an eye-opening show. Thank you for tuning into The Right to Repair Your Gadgets and Why You Should Care. I am your host, Jessica Aldridge, and it is my honor to welcome our guest, Carrie Maeve Sheehan, U.S. Policy Lead for iFixit, and Nathan Proctor, U.S. PERG Senior Right to Repair Campaign Director. Welcome to Eco Justice Radio.
Welcome, everybody.
Hello.
Hi.
Hey, Jessica.
Well, thank you for being here today. I think today's topic is going to come as a serious surprise to many of our listeners. Not only are we as consumers and limited and sometimes legally to fully repair something that we own or take it to a technician of our choice, but the corporate oversight and planned obsolescence is also this major contributor to climate change and toxic waste. Both iFixit and CalPERG are leading on the right to repair movement. We're going to talk about what right to repair means in a moment. So let's start there. Let's understand why this is such an important topic. Carrie, why is it that the consumer isn't allowed to repair their phone or other electronic device? And what is meant by repairable device?
That's a great question, Jessica. So it used to be pretty simple to repair your own devices. We used to be able to get into our devices, open them up, tinker with them, fix them when they broke. But in the last 20 years, we've seen manufacturers employing a new variety of repair restrictions that keep you from being able to fix your stuff when it breaks. And that includes things like hardware restrictions, using specialized screws, gluing devices together so that you can't open them up without destroying the device, and then embedding software in your devices and using certain digital locks to keep you out of that software, and using legal strategies to enforce those locks and keep you from getting around them to get at software and fix your device. And when we talk about what is a repairable device, generally we mean a repairable device is one that you can readily disassemble. So you can take it apart relatively easily using standardly available tools, and one whose key components can be individually replaced. So if your screen breaks, you can replace the screen. If the battery breaks, you can replace the battery. And it doesn't have to be you necessarily the one that's doing this. It can also mean, you know, your choice to be able to take it to a repair provider of your choosing, your independent repair shop, just like we have independent mechanics for our cars. There should be a plethora of independent repair shops for our phones and our tablets and our appliances.
And Nathan, what is meant by right to repair? And briefly, what has been the role of the US PERG?
Yes, thank you. I mean, the idea of right to repair is let people fix their stuff. Companies make products and they withhold the necessary parts or service information or the software to fix that stuff so that they can force people to either go back to the manufacturer for their branded repair service, you know, set at a premium price, or they force you to get new stuff, which is something a lot of people have experienced. And that's, we hate that. We live in the era of just way too much disposable stuff. It's killing the planet. It's absurd and ridiculous. And so part of what Right to Repair is saying is like, give us this, what we need to fix stuff so that we don't have to buy new stuff that we don't really need all the time. And US PERG is a national advocacy organization that stands up for the public interest. And really my role is that I coordinate all these state efforts. And one of the things that's really exciting about Right to Repair, it's kind of come from the bottom up. In the last year, there were 27 different states which had different right to repair laws all over the country. Some that were focused on appliances, some that were, like California was focused on medical devices. In my job as the campaign director at US PERG is to help shepherd and steward all these campaigns bubbling out from all over the place.
Absolutely. And so one thing I just want to reiterate from what Nathan said and from the question you asked me earlier is that, you know, manufacturers are failing to provide the things that they used to provide, which is replacement parts, service information like repair manuals, and the tools needed to do the repairs. And so Right to Repair is really asking for governments to require manufacturers to provide those things to device owners and to independent repair providers.
And I think that's a good lead-in to iFixit, which, Carrie, you work for iFixit. I don't want to spill the beans here, so I want you to describe what iFixit does. I think it's such a pretty amazing resource to the community that you provide and to encourage right to repair. So talk about that for a second.
So iFixit's mission is to make sure that everyone has what they need to be able to repair their devices. And to fulfill that mission, we offer a free open source, internationally translated repair manual for everything. And really, it's everything. It's not just cell phones and tablets and laptops. It's also your cat scratching posts and your Christmas lights, which are annually very popular guides on our site. And all our guides are wikis. And so we have a global community of fixers and tinkerers and repair techs who contribute to these guides and contribute to this community of folks who are passionate about repair. And we also manufacture special repair tools. You know, a while ago, manufacturers started using specialized screw heads, and it was impossible to get the right screwdrivers to take these screw heads off. So iFixit started making tools that would help everyone, whether it's your individual device owner or a professional repair tech, to get tools to, you know, unscrew these fancy proprietary screw heads that these companies have started putting on devices. We also sell repair parts, and we just try to make sure that everyone can get access to the things they need to fix their electronic devices. We work up very closely with US PERG and Nathan and folks at the Repair Association and Consumer Reports to advocate for right to repair laws around the country and internationally.
Amazing. Both of your organizations are doing excellent work. And we're really going to dive here deep into what's really happening around right to repair, what we're being told that we can and cannot do. And I want to start out first here talking about the environmental and social implications of electronic manufacturing and disposal, and how right to repair is a solution against these systems that are causing climate change, that are causing serious impacts, not only to our environment, but to the people who are living around the world. So Nathan, if you could speak to that first in regards to what are these environmental and social implications?
Yeah, I mean, the fact that I find one of the most just incredibly arresting is that Americans dispose of 416,000 smartphones a day. We buy these $1,000 supercomputers. I'm like a big Star Trek fan. They have like literally seven devices on Star Trek to do with one smartphone does, because they just could not imagine having technology this unbelievably useful. And then we treat it as if it's completely disposable. I mean, that's absurd. And it turns out that level of churn of electronics puts a huge toll on the planet. You know, a single phone has dozens and dozens of different components in terms of rare earth materials. Those are mined all over the planet, some of them in horrible conditions, including like conflict minerals. And it takes an incredible amount of energy to produce one cell phone. I think my report, The Fix Is In, found it's like 122 pounds of CO2 equivalent per phone, which means that at 416,000 phones a day that we're buying, that's a huge, huge contributor to climate change. You know, there was one study out of McMaster University in Canada that said it could be 14% of this, you know, internet connected technology manufacturing could be 14% of the global contributions to climate change in the next 20 years. So that's like transportation sector or kind of like in that, at that level. It's a just enormous amount of pollution that we're creating by making disposable technology. And it's not only damaging, it's just patently crazy.
And to be clear, what's the average use of a cell phone before someone throws it away?
Yeah, right. Throw away might not be exactly the words, because mostly they're in the back of your drawer. And if I was to raid your house, I'd find them. But, you know, the real damage is manufacturing. So it doesn't matter where they kind of end up. It matters that more are coming. It's 29 months that Americans, that's the average cycle that Americans are buying new phones. And if we extended that actually by 1 year, so if we added 12 months to that, that would have the same climate benefits as taking 636,000 cars off the road.
That is crazy. Carrie, did you want to add to this conversation?
Yeah, absolutely. As Nathan mentioned, manufacturing new cell phones and new technology is extraordinarily resource intensive. So a 4.5-ounce iPhone requires approximately 295 pounds of raw materials, including ore and water, in order to produce that single iPhone. And Apple's producing, you know, at least a billion new phones per year globally. So that's a massive amount of resources that goes into producing these new phones, which are then treated as disposable objects. Some more information on that. So the energy that a laptop uses in its lifetime, 81% of that energy is consumed during the manufacturing process. And the materials that go into making your phones, so things like tantalum, gold, are considered rare earth materials, and the mining process for them is incredibly destructive. So getting a single ounce of gold out of the earth in order to, you know, put it into your circuit boards and your cell phone can create up to 91 tons of waste for just a single ounce. And then the tantalum mines that we hear about, they often come from highly conflict-fueled areas and often fuel kind of civil wars in Africa, for example. Tantalum is very often used in electronics and is often mined in the DRC, and some of the profits of those go to funding civil wars in Africa.
And in addition to the waste that's happening upstream, which has the biggest environmental footprint, am I wrong in saying that electronic waste at the downstream after it's used and is being disposed of in some manner is one of the largest and fastest growing sectors of waste?
Absolutely. So the UN has flagged electronic waste as the fastest growing waste stream globally.
It's crazy. Well,
and to add to that, the recycling process for e-waste is very destructive. So you'll hear a lot of companies talk about, well, you know, they take back phones or whatever for recycling, but between 20 and 35% of the material content of a phone is lost when that phone is shredded or melted down for recycling. And a lot of these take back programs that feed into recycling programs also require those recyclers to essentially shred the devices, which could include perfectly reasonable devices, perfectly usable devices. There was a lawsuit lawsuit a couple of years ago in Canada. Apple had contracted with a recycler called Geep, who by virtue of their contract with Apple was required to shred the phones that they received through Apple's take back and recycling program. The folks at Geep realized that these were perfectly usable phones. Some of them decided to sell them on the side, get them into the hands of people who could use them because they were still very usable. And they were sued by Apple for not shredding those devices in violation of their contract.
It happens a lot, actually, in the waste industry of different, from clothing to electronics. Let's talk about the strategies employed by manufacturers to undermine reuse and repair. Nathan, how do companies restrict parts and tools and limit authorized repair networks?
There's a couple different main categories of strategy. The first is that you create materials and then you give them exclusively to your like authorized or branded repair center. So you might have this information necessary to do certain kinds of repairs, or you have spare parts. Like, for example, Apple buys its parts from this company called Intercell, one of the chip vendors that it uses to assemble the iPhones. And they have an exclusive contract with that supplier. And as part of that contract, they say you cannot sell this same product to a repair shop who might be wanting to fix this. And that gives Apple essentially a monopoly on the supply of that chip. So that's like one kind of exclusive contract. And then the other is they design these products with software. And the software is like needed to authenticate a repair or to calibrate the blah, blah, blah. And then they make that software exclusive to their authorized dealers. I mean, it's kind of like if you have a car, you know that you can like take it to the dealer and they'll charge you an arm and a leg, or you could take it to the local mechanic and they'll charge you a lot less, but at least you have that option. What the manufacturers are trying to do is to force everyone to have to go to the dealer so they can charge you anything they want or force you into an upgrade.
And the other strategy, or one of the other strategies, is putting no effort or thought into designing for repair. Can you also speak to that, Nathan?
Yeah, we live in the age of like disposable planet killing crap, and we need to stop it. So a lot of companies make products and there's literally no thought to how this could possibly be repaired. And I've heard stories of people who call and say, hey, my coffee maker stopped working. I would like warranty repair. And they're like, repair? Just take a photo of you cutting the power cord off the product so we know that it can never be used again and we'll send you a new one. This is how this stuff is working, because it's cheap to manufacture and they don't feel like training repair labor. And so they just replace everything. And that's just crazy.
And that doesn't just happen with coffee makers. Like, we've seen laptops that are entirely glued together that you cannot fix without disassembling and destroying the laptop. So it runs the gamut between the kind of cheap throwaway technology to these more expensive devices that manufacturers are just not planning for a repair cycle for.
Yeah, it's even infecting the luxury items now. It used to be just like the stuff you'd buy at Target. But now, yeah, Microsoft in 2017, their Surface Pro, I mean, iFixit gave like a 0 out of 10 on the repair score because it was just completely glued together. There was absolutely no way to repair it if it broke.
It's true. Yeah, we usually score things from 1 to 10 in our repairability scoring. We've been scoring phones, laptops, tablets for repairability for over a decade. And it's usually a 1 to 10 score, but the original Microsoft Surface laptop did get a 0, in part because it was the entire body of the laptop was ultrasonically welded together. And then a fabric cover glued on top of it, and the battery was glued in. So it was just, this thing was just a glued together, welded together mass that you really could not get in and fix without utterly destroying the entire thing.
Completely asinine. I can't even believe that companies can get away with this. But we're going to bring this conversation back after the break and take a short break here. So everyone listening, stay tuned and we'll be right back.
Hey listeners, quick break here. We hope that you're enjoying Eco Justice Radio. We air every Monday at 9 a.m. on KPFT Houston and every Wednesday at 3 p.m. on KPFK Los Angeles. Stay connected by subscribing to Eco Justice Radio on all major podcast apps and visit our website, ecojusticeradio.org, to check out previous shows and guests and get connected with us on social media. Today, you are listening to The Right to Repair Your Gadgets and Why You Should Care with host Jessica Aldridge and guest Carrie Maeve Sheehan. You U.S. Policy Lead for iFixit, and Nathan Proctor, U.S. PIRG Senior Right to Repair Campaign Director.
So we're talking about right to repair, the ability to just simply repair our items, be they electronics or something else, and what the right to repair movement is. And we were talking about some of those restrictions. Carrie, what are the legal restrictions to having the right to repair your items?
Great question. So the biggest legal restriction, which is also the most absurd legal restriction, is that in many cases, copyright law prevents you from repairing your devices. Now, when we normally think about copyright law, we think about protecting, you know, music and films. And Congress in 1998, responding to concerns from the entertainment industry, passed what's called the Digital Millennium Copyright Act. And part of that law protects what's called technological protection measures. They're also familiarly known as digital locks that manufacturers use to control access to copyrighted works. So that could be, you know, controlling access. It could be the DRM on your CD or your DVD, but it could also be the digital locks that keep you out of the software on your devices. And that's where it starts to impact repair and a lot of other perfectly legitimate, not copyright infringing activities. So this section of this law, section 1201 of the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, it prohibits getting around or circumventing those digital locks in order to get at the embedded software in your devices. And repair in a lot of circumstances with modern software-enabled devices, which is virtually every device at this point, requires getting into that software, whether it's to authorize a replacement part, pair one part to another part, complete a repair, or fix a bug in the software that's making the device malfunction. And this is a pretty bad law. It comes with, you know, substantial civil and criminal penalties if you violate it just for, you know, circumventing those digital locks to try to fix your device. So there is a process in the U.S. Through the United States Copyright Office, which is required by this law. The U.S. Copyright Office has to run this triennial proceeding where folks like iFixit and other folks who want to fix their stuff or want to use accessibility technology like screen readers have to petition for and argue for exemptions to this very overbroad kind of draconian law about digital locks. And that process happens every 3 years, involves, you know, asking the Copyright Office to, you know, please let us fix our cell phones or our appliances or our tractors, and going through multiple rounds of comments and oral arguments at hearings, just to try to get these kind of term limited 3-year exemptions to this overbroad area of copyright law, just to let us fix our stuff, which is patently absurd. Like, copyright law should not prevent you from fixing your tractor or your car or your washing machine. So one thing that iFixit is really pushing for now, and which we'd really love to see, is congressional reform of that part of the law to create a kind of permanent clarification that, look, like, this law was never intended to prevent you from fixing your stuff. It was intended to crack down on DVD piracy online, but it was never meant to keep you from fixing your tractor or fixing your cell phone or fixing your coffee maker.
So while we're on this topic, what is the misconception around these warnings that say your warranty will be voided by repairing this item?
Ah, that's a great question, because that is a lie.
So, did you hear that, everyone? That is a lie.
So there is a law in the United States called the Magnuson-Moss Warranty Act, and that prevents manufacturers from voiding the warranty on your device if you open it up and repair it yourself or access a third-party repair service. And it prevents them from telling you that. And it also prevents them from using such stickers like warranty void if removed on devices. A lot of manufacturers still do it, regardless of the fact that this law is in place. We're looking forward to seeing the Federal Trade Commission, who's charged with enforcing this law, taking a more aggressive stance on these. A few years ago, the FTC sent a number of letters to about 8 companies, including video game console manufacturers, who were unlawfully using these warranty void if removed stickers on their devices. And if, you know, it's a big problem, because most people think, like, you still, even in the repair world, people think, if I repair my device or if I open it up, it's going to void my warranty and I won't be able to get warranty coverage. But that's just not true. And it's a erroneous and potentially fraudulent claim made by manufacturers. There are a few exemptions, but in most cases, they don't apply. And, you know, manufacturers just can't void your warranty because you merely used an independent repair service or repaired it yourself.
Well, that's really good to know. And, you know, Nathan, I should have asked this earlier when you were talking about some of the strategies that they use, but there's this term called planned obsolescence. And I was hoping that you might be able to quickly define what that means.
Yeah, I mean, it was coined when light bulb manufacturers realized, they actually had like a cabal, literally, where they were like, oh, shoot, we can make light bulbs that'll last for super long time, and then people won't need to buy new light bulbs. So let's make them so that they break after 1,000 hours. That's the idea of setting product lifespans in such a way that encourages people to buy new stuff. Now, this idea, whether or not it's by negligence or kind of whether or not there's another some other cabal meetings that we don't know about, products are just getting unbelievably short lifespans. I mean, like 20 years ago, a fridge might last 20 years. But, you know, the most recent estimate I've seen is it's more like 13 years now. But that was 6-7 years ago. So it's probably shrunk even farther. So every year, instead of making products that are better and last longer, they're making things that break sooner. And, you know, and this is just terrible for the planet. And really, one of the huge parts of this puzzle is the fact that we've lost an ecosystem of repair and maintenance that used to exist. And now the part of what we're trying to do is to restore that, both in terms of what people expect to do and what their behavior is, the way things are designed, and then also what options exist for professional repair.
And let's talk about some of those. We keep saying sort of generally like medical devices or farming devices or our cell phone. Let's get into the nitty gritty here a bit and talk about some of the companies or the industries that are leading that opposition on the right to repair movement. Because it sounds like to me, politicians and the general public, they're like, yeah, why don't we have right to repair? This sounds great. Let's push it at the political level and be done with it. But that's not happening. So one of those, what's happening with John Deere? They're the maker of agricultural machinery like tractors. How are they disallowing farmers, you know, in the heart of our country, how are they disallowing them to repair their own equipment? And why is that a problem?
Yeah, I mean, so for farm equipment, there's a really specific problem, which is that there's an exclusive set of software tools that are only available to dealers. And so John Deere is one of these companies that, unlike, you know, some industries where there's a lot of options, John Deere has a massive quantity of the market share, and they have a lot more, you know, kind of dealers all over the place. And one of the ways in which they're taking more money is by trying to monopolize the service of all the equipment back to their dealers. And, you know, and this is largely accomplished with software. So if you have a piece of equipment and you're running it in a field and you're doing some, you know, harvesting, and there's an error, the equipment might, you know, kind of go into lockdown, and you cannot reset that equipment without this John Deere Service Advisor software, which is exclusive to the dealer. So you have to go to your dealer to get certain kinds of repairs done, because if it trips certain kinds of software lockouts, there's no other option, except if you take to like hacking the equipment. And so Vice has this amazing documentary, which people should go and watch, about, you know, farmers in Nebraska who are buying cracked John Deere software from like Ukrainian hackers on BitTorrent sites, you know, just to be able to fix equipment so they don't lose their livelihood because the equipment went down and the dealer couldn't fix it in time.
And there's also a similar story with medical equipment. And, you know, during COVID, ventilators have been extremely necessary, but also hard to come by with so many hospitalizations. So fixing on site those that are broken, I would just assume is a no-brainer. And also another issue is the United States. We send old medical equipment to foreign countries that can't afford to buy that equipment new. But then some of the equipment that arrives, it's broken. It needs to be fixed. But then the people who are there, they don't have the resources and the information to fix it, or maybe even the legal right to fix it. So it just seems morally reprehensible to not allow for the fixing and upgrading of medical equipment. Carrie, what is going on here?
Yeah. So historically, hospitals have been able to fix their own equipment. Most hospitals, or at least the major hospitals, have staff of biomedical repair technicians who are like the ninjas of the hospital and kind of fix the medical devices when they break, replace them before they can be missed, and make sure that those devices get pressed back into urgent patient care as needed. But again, with the kind of penetration of software into every device, medical devices are increasingly software enabled, and manufacturers have used that as a way to lock down access to the service terminals, access to service information, restrict who can repair those devices, and try to lock hospitals into these expensive, often lengthy service agreements with the repair providers, with the manufacturers, rather than using their own repair providers or an independent service organization to repair their devices when they break, which generally, we've heard cost about 30 to 50% less than getting the manufacturer in to repair a medical device when it's broken. And, you know, when hospitals have relied on manufacturers, a lot of them report substantial delays in getting the manufacturer's technicians out to repair their devices, which is unexcusable when you think that, you know, the independent repair providers in the area or the hospital's own biomedical technicians, who are just as qualified as the manufacturer's technicians, could be repairing that device and getting it back into service immediately. So Nathan's organization did a great survey at the beginning of the pandemic that looked at, you know, both ventilator repair specifically and medical device repair more broadly. And that survey showed that 69% of their survey respondents handled ventilator repair, and that around 30% of those couldn't use the ventilators that they had because they didn't have access to the parts and service information. So the manufacturers were restricting access to the parts and service information that they needed to get those ventilators out of the broken ventilator storage rooms and back into use, where they were very much needed during the pandemic. And part of this broader study, they looked beyond just ventilators and at all equipment in general, and not over 90% of the folks that they surveyed had been denied access to service information for critical medical equipment, including like defibrillators and anesthesia machines and imaging equipment. So the crackdown that's happening, where manufacturers are locking people out of being able to access and service their devices, and anti-competitively restricting the access that independents could have to repair these devices, isn't just happening in your phones or your tractors or your consumer devices. It's also happening to medical equipment, and it's locking hospitals themselves out of that equipment. And much like we've talked about the farmers that were using hacked Ukrainian software to repair their devices, Vice also reported earlier last year on hospital repair techs that were having to use, you know, cracked software from Poland in order to get their ventilators back up and running again.
This just sounds like gross negligence. Like it being in a situation like COVID and having to need ventilators in order to save people's lives, and then denying the ability to fix those ventilators, to me sounds like gross negligence.
You know, the hilarious thing. So we have all these lobbyists, right? Who, whenever that we, like I said, it's 27 states that have bills this year. Every one of these bills comes up. So we come in and say, listen, it's crazy that if you're a hospital, they don't let you fix your equipment. Someone's about to die. They won't let you have the parts. And the manufacturer's response is, we just want to make sure that the repairs are done properly. And, you know, we want to keep you safe. So we're going to keep you safe by making decisions like you're not allowed to fix it without us, even if that's a life or death choice for a hospital. And as one of the biomeds said to me, oh, can you come up with a time when it's been life or death and you really had this thing on the line? And his response is it's always life and death. Every time this equipment always is needed, somebody's life is at risk.
Yeah, when someone needs a ventilator, that's a medical emergency. I would also assume that if, you know, these fees, these costs to fix the medical equipment and going through these avenues that are demanded by the manufacturers, if they were able to participate in right to repair, maybe the hospital costs would also go down. Is that a correct assumption on my part?
Absolutely. I think, you know, from our conversations with biomedical repair technicians across the country, their services, independent services from independent service organizations, charge about 30 to 50% less than the manufacturer's technicians. And it's not inconceivable that those costs then filter down to the patients at those hospitals or to the insurance companies and then to the patients. And there are also broader equity impacts to that. So, for example, while a major hospital in a major metropolitan area in the U.S. may not have as big of a problem getting access through manufacturer services. Maybe they can afford it. Maybe it's closer. Rural hospitals, rural medical clinics in other parts of the world that are less well-resourced will have an even harder time getting those manufacturer service technicians out there and really struggle with being able to provide care to their patients. There's a great story that Rest of World wrote on infant incubators and the difficulty with repairing infant incubators in Tanzania. And I really recommend checking that story out.
Thank you. So this is a lot of information to take in. It's a lot of realizations, I think, for many of our listeners. So let's talk about solutions and how to move the dial on right to repair. Nathan, how do you mobilize people and get them to care, especially since I don't think many people know about right to repair and the issues?
Yeah, I mean, it's true. Like the polling that we've seen shows that if you explain the issue, you get something like 85% support or something somewhere thereabouts with, you know, 5 or 6% opposition. So it's overwhelming public support. But yet there are these entrenched special interests that, you know, kind of make stuff and don't want to change the way they're doing it. You know, I had a quick study that calculated the total market value of all the companies that set up to lobby against us. And it was $10.7 trillion worth of opposition. But yet we're still like having these big breakthroughs, and we'll talk a little bit more about that in a sec. But one of the things that I think is really making a difference is we've really gone from the bottom up, and we've organized, you know, people who care about the environment, people who teach STEM education, people who run repair shops, people who are in, you know, reuse and people who are part of repair cafes, which are these free community events that people fix stuff together. And we've gotten them to kind of push at the state level where we can begin to build some momentum and build a campaign. And we've seen how that's kind of built from the bottom up.
And what about right to repair legislation? Do we need to keep an eye out at our state and local level? Are things happening?
Like I said, 27 states. So there is a better than even odd that you're listening to this in a U.S. state that had a bill so far this year. And so you can go to, you know, repair.org where they have an updated map of all the states and you can see how you can plug in. But, you know, one of the things that's really exciting about doing a state level campaign is, you know, you can actually influence state lawmakers. Like if you sit down and meet with them, if you make a case, it's actually really eye opening for people to have that experience to like actually lobby their state, like of a repair shop, these people who are completely non-political, which is kind of an interesting part of this campaign, and to have them get their lawmaker to start advocating for them. It makes them realize that like democracy might be kind of in a weird state right now, but it's still like the best thing we've got. Like, well, and while we still have it, let's use it to solve the problems of the people.
And just as Brandeis famously said, that the states are the laboratories for democracy, right? So it's while there are interesting opportunities at the federal level and interesting opportunities in Congress, you're much closer to your state representatives and you have a much greater chance of talking with them directly, influencing them as their constituent, as someone whose interests they're obligated to represent. And really, we're really excited to see all these state level developments. And I think that's where the real right to repair policy is going to come from.
So before we go to the break, I just want to remind our listeners to go to repair.org and always, always, always call your state legislators. Please call them. That really does a lot, not just signing petitions, but calling them and letting them know where you stand. So we're going to take a quick break and come right back and continue this conversation about solutions to support right to repair.
Hey, listeners, quick break here. We hope that you're enjoying Eco Justice Radio. We air every Monday at 9 a.m. on KPFT Houston and every Wednesday at 3 p.m. on KPFK Los Angeles. Stay connected by subscribing to Eco Justice Radio on all major podcast apps and visit our website, ecojusticeradio.org, to check out previous shows and guests and get connected with us on social media. Today, you are listening to The Right to Repair Your Gadgets and Why You Should Care with host Jessica Aldridge and guest Carrie Maeve Sheehan, U.S. Policy Lead for iFixit, and Nathan Proctor, U.S. PERG Senior Right to Repair Campaign Director.
So we've been talking about Right to Repair and the Right to Repair campaign and how we as consumers are not always able to repair our items. And sometimes we're not legally allowed to repair our items, from medical equipment to agricultural equipment to cell phones to whatever it might be. But there's something happening at the federal level. And Carrie, I was hoping you could speak to this. The Biden administration signed an executive order that is meant to support right to repair. What are they proposing? And do you feel that it goes far enough? And has anything started yet?
I think it's the latest testament to the fact that right to repair is the sensation that's sweeping the nation. You know, as Nathan mentioned, we had 27 states introduce right to repair laws last year. And then we had some really encouraging developments at the federal level, one of which is the Biden administration's executive order, and which instructs the Federal Trade Commission to use its rulemaking authority to create new rules around around unfair or deceptive repair restrictions. So the Federal Trade Commission is what's called an independent commission. So the Biden administration can't directly instruct them to do things the way it might do with an executive agency it has direct influence over, but it can encourage the Federal Trade Commission, which I think the Federal Trade Commission would be, you know, very reluctant to ignore, to start moving policy in a particular direction. And we already saw some interest from the FTC on that earlier this year. In May, they released a report on following up on a workshop they did a couple of years ago called Nixing the Fix. And the report looked at, you know, all of the evidence that was presented during that workshop from repair advocates, repair shops, independent repair technicians, as well as the manufacturers, and looked at the manufacturers' arguments in favor of restricting repair or in favor of locking people out of their devices, and found that each of those arguments was really lacking an evidentiary foundation. Basically, that none of these manufacturer arguments carried water, and there wasn't really evidence to support any of them. And so we're seeing the FTC kind of move forward on that report, on its findings in that report, on the Biden administration's encouragement, and start to take right to repair more seriously. So they unanimously adopted a policy statement saying that they're going to start enforcing on right to repair more and considering using the FTC's resources to create new right to repair rules, which we're very excited about and really encourage the FTC to move forward on quickly.
Nathan, just want to check in with you. Is there anything that you wanted to add to that?
I mean, it's not every day that the President of the United States calls and says, "Yeah, you guys are right." And the thing that my reflection on it as a person who's been kind of organizing this and trying to convince activists and DIYers and tinkerers and repair shops to take action is like, when you build it, if you have the truth on your side, you can get there. It was a really encouraging thing, but I mean, my takeaway is like, there's a lot that the FTC can do, but ultimately we have to keep pushing. The way we got to attracting the FTC's attention to this issue is like a lot of people got involved. They get a lot more people involved. And now we're at a place where we've got the wind at our back and we're close to getting some real victories in place, but we're not there yet.
Absolutely. And, you know, the FTC has limited authority. They have to work with what they can do under their enacting statute. So what they can define as an unfair method of competition or as a deceptive practice. And so, you know, it's really one part of a larger kind of patchwork solution where you have state legislatures, federal legislatures, and the executive branch working together to protect consumers' right to repair, you know, through the state legislation that Nathan talked about, through copyright reform that I talked about, and through the FTC's own actions, cracking down on repair restrictions.
In 2020, the European Union approved to follow through on some ambitious measures to ensure right to repair by implementing a repairability scorecard for all of the electronic devices and repairability rules for computers. How does this scorecard work and when will this be enforced?
Great question. So what happened is January of 2020, France enacted a repairability scoring law, repairability labeling law. We consulted with them and they consulted with various stakeholders to develop a kind of scoring matrix by which you could assign a repairability score to your cell phone or other product, which included things like how easy it is to replace parts. Are parts generally available for purchase? Is repair information available to someone who wants to repair their device? And we're already starting to see companies kind of falling in line and starting to improve their behaviors in order to get a better repair score. And one of the purposes of the law is really to bridge the information gap between consumers and manufacturers. So when you go to buy your washing machine or your cell phone, it's really difficult to tell, you know, looking at devices in the store or online, which one is more repairable than another. There's a real like kind of dearth of information about repairability of these products. And so you can't use your purchasing power to choose one that you think is going to be more repairable. And what this French labeling law does is it requires manufacturers to label those products at point of sale with their repairability score. So when you go walk into the store or when you go to the website to buy your new cell phone, that has to be labeled with a repairability score that's assigned through this matrix. So you as a consumer now have more information about, you know, whether an iPhone or a Samsung or a Fairphone is more repairable. And we're, as I mentioned, we're seeing manufacturers change their behaviors for that. So Samsung, who has, you know, fought tooth and nail against right to repair measures in the US, and those very right to repair measures, which would require them to make service manuals available in the US, is now making their service manuals publicly available in France. And, you know, companies are starting to, you know, make more information about repairability more available, make spare parts more available so that they can compete better in the market and get a better repair score and therefore influence consumer decisions. The EU has indicated an interest in expanding this region wide, starting, I think, first with cell phones.
Carrie, if someone wants to go about fixing their own electronics, like right now, if they're like, I have something, I want to fix it, or I have some equipment, can they do that? How do they go about that legally? And then on top of that, how are repair shops faring recently?
I mean, I would say you can start by going to ifixit.com and looking at our repair guides, because as I said before, we have a repair guide for virtually everything in the world. And we also do teardowns of new devices. So a new device comes on the market and we get in line to get it first and take it apart and score it for repairability and, you know, document the process of taking it apart and putting it back together. So that's where I would start for fixing something yourself and also, you know, take your devices to independent repair shops. They need your support. And there are still plenty of them out there, although they are suffering with these new repair restrictions and really, you know, fighting hard to stay alive. And they really need you to come in and give them your business. I think, you know, we're hopeful that right to repair legislation and some of the steps the FTC is taking will help level the playing field a little bit more for these independent repair shops and make sure that manufacturers provide them with the parts, tools, and information that they're already providing to their own in-house technicians. But they still need your support. So I would check out ifixit.com and go to your local repair shops.
And then Nathan, you had also mentioned, and I'm sure Carrie, you love these as well. There's the repair cafes, right? You know, how you have someone else teach you how to fix your product.
Yeah. I mean, I had somebody say like the most meaningful barrier to like fixing something is like undoing the first screw. And sometimes you just need someone to sit there with you and just tell you, yes, you can try this. Or if you don't have the skills, somebody who can maybe teach you something. And so there are all these free events all over the country. They're known as repair cafes or fix it clinics or restart parties. Those are the three different nonprofits that do this. You can go online. They do them on Zoom now. You can just bring a broken product and get some expert guidance about how to fix it. Fixing stuff is empowering. It's fun. It's kind of like, you know, it's taking a stand against planned obsolescence and fighting for, control, bringing the control of technology back to the people. So I think these are beautiful celebrations of community, and they're super multi-generational. I think repair cafes are a lot of fun.
Yeah, and a huge shout out to everyone who's been running repair cafes, to the Restart Project, to Peter Mui, who's also California based, who's running a lot of these fix-it clinics. You know, they've been kind of doing the work and you know, educating people about repair, making sure people have access to resources and community, and you know, huge shout out to all of them. We really appreciate all the work that they're doing.
Really do. And I love those repair cafes. And I love that you can do them via Zoom, but when they're in person, it's so much fun and seeing all the different tables and people teaching you how to fix items. And yeah, it's amazing. Well, I have a few more questions just to jump around here for a moment before we close off the show here. How are manufacturers of these products that we would like to repair working with the U.S. Customs and Border Protection to circumvent the repair market?
So it's interesting. So, right. So if you can't buy parts direct from the manufacturer because they refuse to sell them and you're a repair shop, how do you get parts? And so you order parts. Sometimes you order them, you know, from a third party supplier, which might be taking recycled parts. Like they might be disassembled, or there might be, you might have scrapped old laptops and they might be taking the batteries out and then selling them to repair shops to use to fix those computers. And that's one of the ways that repair shops get parts. But customs is known to like seize the recycled parts as trademark violations because, you know, there's an Apple logo on it or there's a Samsung logo on it. And then Samsung says, oh, that's counterfeit. Even if it isn't, even if it's, they're just recycled parts. And there's actually like a repair shop in Norway, and he had these refurbished, you know, screens, and they had some Apple components and some third party components. And he was, you know, selling them as refurbished screens, not Apple screens. But Apple said it was counterfeit. And then they sued basically this repair shop into oblivion. And so, yes, it's this huge weaponization of the, you know, copyright and trademark system to make it really difficult for people to source parts. And it's, you know, and if we don't stand up and start making some noise, it could get worse. I mean, there are proposals to dramatically expand the power of Customs and Border Patrol to seize stuff if manufacturers deem that it's in violation of whatever rules they've set.
Now, is there a story about Apple going into a repair shop and just, you know, an Apple executive and just saying, nope, get rid of that, get rid of that, get rid of that, seize that here in the United States?
Yeah, this is you know, Vice and Jason Kevler at Motherboard and Vice has been on this beat for a long time. And he's uncovered some really outrageous stuff over the years. And in one of the stories he reported, I think it was like 2011 in Florida, they you know, was it Homeland Security? I'm forgetting now. DHS.
I think it was DHS.
Yeah, DHS went in with a representative from the company and they indicated which products they felt to be a violation. And they just took the property right out of the store with no legal recourse or, I mean, that's kind of like the dystopian picture of how government works. Like some corporate person just coming in and telling and, you know, advising the government what to seize of your stuff because they deem it to be a copyright violation or whatever. It's outrageous. These shops are just trying to fix people's phones because it's so expensive or Apple won't do it. And they have to face all these barriers. And, you know, one thing that repair shops have told me is that, like, you know, Right to Repair is like the reason why they're still here. If we weren't out there kind of rattling, you know, the cages on this, Apple would have, you know, these other manufacturers, they just keep on ramping up all these restrictions because they don't want these repair shops out there. They don't want anyone saying, don't listen to the manufacturer. I could totally get your data back. I could totally restart this thing. I could totally fix that. It's not totaled. You could still use this. They don't want that out there. And so they take a really adversarial role to these businesses.
And we have just a couple more minutes left here. But Carrie, did you want to say anything about the role that Apple, beyond that, what the role Apple has played in the fight against Right to Repair legislation?
Yeah, and Nathan can talk about this as well. But Apple's been a major lobbyist against Right to Repair legislation in the U.S. And through their own direct interactions with legislatures and through their trade associations like TechNet, they've really kind of brought their influence to bear on state legislatures to try to dissuade them from passing Right to Repair laws. And as Nathan said, like, we're fighting against, you know, trillions of dollars in market capital, but we're still winning. And so as much as Apple wants to fight and wants to use its resources to fight Right to Repair, you know, the power of the people is going to beat them every time. And we're really showing that on the state level and on the federal level that, you know, they are not going to win this one. And it's just a matter of time before they realize it.
The power of the people is going to beat them every time. Very much. So before we end the show here, where can people get more information about both of your organizations? I know you've said it throughout, but you know, three times the charm, right? And telling people, go here. So what's your website? And then also, what are your social media handles that people can check out? Nathan, I'll start with you.
You can go to uspirg.org/repair. You can get a subdomain, and you can find a little bit more specifically about the campaign. And I'm on Twitter at nproctor, P-R-O-C-T-O-R. I guarantee that I'm a fun follow because I've been told so by many people, my mom included.
I love this marketing. This is great. Carrie, where can people find you and find iFixit?
At ifixit.com, ifixit.com. And if you want to find out more information about how to get involved in your state legislation or how to support state legislative efforts for right to repair, you can go to repair.org/standup with the hyphen between the stand and the up. And you can find me on Twitter at caremave, capital K, capital M. I'm probably not as fun of a follow as Nathan, but I'm getting there. Working on it.
We'll make sure that we tag the organizations and y'all in the posts. And so everyone, make sure that you are also following Eco Justice Radio. And so you can get even more information and subscribe to the podcast. Well, thank you both, Nathan and Carrie, for being here today. I really appreciate you. This has been an eye-opening and a bit frustrating conversation, but I do feel for myself that, you know, I'm going to be calling my state legislature and demanding some responsibility. Thank you to you both for being on the show.
Thank you. It's been so much
fun.
Thank
you.
Thank you to our guests today, Carrie Maeve Sheehan and Nathan Proctor. And thank you to our listeners for joining us. This has been Right to Repair Your Gadgets and Why You Should Care. Please connect with us on social media at EcoJustice Radio, SoCal350, and Adventures in Waste. If you like what you heard and you want others to be informed, well, you know what to do. Subscribe to our podcast, share the episodes, and get that information out there. You have been listening to Eco Justice Radio on KPFK Los Angeles, a project of SoCal 350. The show can be found on kpfk.org, all major podcast apps, and at ecojusticeradio.org. Created by Mark and JP Morris, executive producer Jack Eit, producer and co-host Jessica Aldridge, co-host Carrie Kim, engineer Blake Lampkin, and original music by Javier Cadre. And until next time, remember, the power is yours.